The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the ninth reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Dewar. I'm Jim Abate. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may contain explicit descriptions that some people could find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In our last reading, Friedrich took Werner to his parents' apartment. On the elevator, he met their Jewish neighbor, who Friedrich's mother said later would not be living there much longer. Friedrich revealed that he wears glasses, passing the eye exams by memorizing all four of the charts. Friedrich showed him his Audubon books, which had to be kept hidden because Audubon was an American. Werner had never seen anything as sumptuous as the apartment. On their 20th day after Marie-Laure's father left, Etienne found out he never made it to Paris. In February, the cadets are aroused at 2 a.m. and brought to the quadrangle where a prisoner is strapped to a stake. The boys and the faculty are ordered to douse the freezing prisoner with a bucket of water. Friedrich refused. Madame Manek started taking Marie-Laure to the beach, and she does this every day. Marie brought back shells, barnacles, lumps of quartz, and so forth. Sergeant Major von Rumpel discovered that the stone from the museum was a fake. He found out how many replicas were made. Three times in 9 days, Friedrich is selected as the weakest and ends up being beaten with the rubber hose each time. Dr. Hauptmann took Werner and Volkheimer to the forest. Volkheimer has concealed himself somewhere out there with a KX transmitter, and Werner is tasked with finding him with the transceiver. Werner said he found him and is leading Dr. Hauptmann to Volkmann, as we now continue with All the Light We Cannot See. They drop into a ravine and climb out. 1 kilometer. 2. Sublimity, Hauptmann says, panting. You know what that is, Fenning? He is tipsy, animated, almost prattling. Never has Werner seen him like this. It's the instant when one thing is about to become something else. Day to night, caterpillar to butterfly, fawn to doe, experiment to result, boy to man. Far up a third climb, Werner unfolds the map and double-checks his bearings with a compass. Everywhere the silent trees gleam. No tracks save their own. The school lost behind them.
Shall I set out the transceivers again, sir?
Hauptmann puts his fingers to his lips. Werner triangulates again and sees how close they are to his original reading, under half a kilometer. He repacks the transceivers and picks up his pace, hunting now. On the scent, all three dogs sensing it too, and Werner thinks, I have found a way in. I am solving it. The numbers are becoming real, and the trees unload shiftings of snow, and the dogs freeze and twitch their noses, locked on a scent, pointing as if at a pheasant, and Hauptmann holds up a palm, and finally Werner, coming up through a gap between trees, laboring as he carries the big cases, sees the form of a man lying face up in the snow, transmitter at his feet, antenna rising into the low branches. The giant. The dogs tremble in their stances. Hauptmann keeps his palms up. With his other hand, he unholsters his pistol. This close, Fenning. You cannot hesitate. Volkheimer's left side faces them. Werner can see the vapor of his breath rise and disperse. Hauptmann aims his Walther right at Volkheimer, and for a long and startling moment, Werner is certain that his teacher is about to shoot the boy, that they are in grave danger, every single cadet, and he cannot help but hear Jutta as she stood beside the canal. Is it right to do something only because everyone else is doing it? Something in Werner's soul shuts its scaly eyes, and the little professor raises his pistol and fires it into the sky. Volkheimer leaps immediately into a squat, his head coming around as the hounds release toward him, and Werner's heart feels as if it has been blown to pieces in his chest. Bolkheimer's arms come up as the dogs charge him, but they know him. They are leaping on him in play, barking and scampering, and Werner watches the huge boy throw off the dogs as if they were house cats. Dr. Hauptmann laughs. His pistol smokes, and he takes a long drink from his flask and passes it to Werner, and Werner puts it to his lips. He has pleased his professor after all. The transceivers work, and he is out in the luminous starlit night, feeling the stinging glow of brandy flow into his gut. "This," says Hauptmann, "is what we're doing with the triangles." The dogs circle and duck and romp. Hauptmann relieves himself beneath the trees. Bolkheimer trudges towards Werner, lugging the big KX transmitter. He grows ever larger. He rests a huge mittened hand on Werner's cap.
"It's only numbers," he says quietly enough that Hauptmann cannot hear. "Pure math, cadet," adds Werner, mimicking Hauptmann's clipped accent.
He presses his gloved fingertips together, all 5 to 5.
"You have to accustom yourself to thinking that way."
It is the first time Werner has heard Bolkheimer laugh, and his countenance changes. He becomes less menacing and more like a benevolent, humongous child, more like the person he becomes when he listens to music. All the next day, the pleasure of his success lingers in Werner's blood, the memory of how it seemed almost holy to him to walk beside big Bolkheimer back to the castle, down through the frozen trees, past the rooms of sleeping boys, ranked like gold bars in strong rooms. Werner felt an almost fatherly protectiveness for the others as he undressed beside his bunk. As lumbering Bolkheimer continued on toward the dormitories of the upperclassmen, an ogre among angels, a keeper crossing a field of gravestones at night. Proposal. Marie-Laure sits in her customary spot in the corner of the kitchen, closest to the fireplace, and listens to the friends of Madame Manette complain.
"The price of mackerel," says Madame Fontenot. "You'd think they'd had to sail to Japan for it." "I cannot remember," says Madame Ebard, the postmistress, "what a proper plum tastes like." "And these ridiculous shoe ration coupons," says Madame Ruel, the baker's wife. "Theo has number 3501, and they haven't even called 400. "It's not just the brothels on the Rue Trevenard anymore. They're giving all the summer apartments to the freelancers. Big Claude and his wife are getting extra fat. Damn boches have their lights on all day. I cannot bear one more night stuck indoors with my husband."
9 of them sit around the square table, knees pressed to knees, ration card restrictions, abysmal puddings, the deteriorating quality of fingernail varnish. These are crimes they feel in their souls. To hear so many of them in a room together confuses and excites Marie-Laure. They are giddy when they should be serious, somber after jokes. Madame Ebard cries over the non-availability of Demerara sugar. Another woman's complaint about tobacco disintegrates mid-sentence into hysterics about the phenomenal size of the perfumer's backside. They smell of stale bread, of stuffy living rooms crammed with dark Titanic Breton furnishings. Madame Ruel says,
"So the Gautier girl wants to get married. The family has to melt all its jewelry to get the gold for the wedding ring. The gold takes taxed 30% by occupation authorities. Then the jeweler's work is taxed another 30%. By the time they've paid him, there's no ring left."
The exchange rate is a farce. The price of carrots indefensible. Duplicity lives everywhere. Eventually, Madame Manette deadbolts the kitchen door and clears her throat. The women fall quiet.
"We're the ones who make their world run," Madame Manette says. "You, Madame Jubot, your son repairs their shoes. Madame Ebard, you and your daughter sort their mail. And you, Madame Ruel, your bakery makes much of their bread."
The air stretches tight. Marie Laura has the sense that they are watching someone slide onto thin ice or hold a palm over a flame.
What are you saying? That we do something. Put bombs in their shoes? Poop in the bread dough?
Brittle laughter.
Nothing so bold as all that. But we could do smaller things, simpler things.
Like what?
First, I need to know if you're willing.
A charged silence ensues. Marie Laura can feel them all poised there, nine minds swinging slowly around. She thinks of her father, imprisoned for what, and aches. Two women leave, claiming obligations involving grandchildren. Others tug at their blouses and rattle their chairs as though the temperature of the kitchen has gone up. Six remain. Marie Laura sits among them, wondering who will cave, who will tattle, who will be the bravest, who will lie on her back and let her last breath curl up to the ceiling as a curse upon the invaders. You have other friends.
Look at Pusswood,
Martin Burkhard yells as Friedrich crosses the quad.
I'm coming for you tonight.
He convulses his pelvic maniacally. Someone defecates on Friedrich's bunk. Werner hears Volkheimer's voice. Decency does not matter to them.
Bedshitter, spits a boy. Bring me my boots.
Friedrich pretends not to hear. Night after night, Werner retreats into Hauptmann's laboratory. Three times now they have gone out into the snow to track down Volkheimer's transmitter, and each time they have found him more directly. During the most recent field test, Werner managed to set up the transceivers, find the transmission, and plot Volkheimer's location on the map in under 5 minutes. Hauptmann promises trips to Berlin. He unrolls schematics from an electronics factory in Austria and says,
Several ministries have demonstrated enthusiasm for our project.
Werner is succeeding. He is being loyal. He is being what everybody agrees is good. And yet, every time he wakes and buttons his tunic, he feels he is betraying something. One night, he and Volkheimer trudge back through the slush, Volkheimer carrying the transmitter, both receivers, and the folded antenna under one arm. Werner walks behind, content to be in his shadow. The trees drip. Their branches seem moments away from erupting into bloom. Spring. In two more months, Volkheimer will be given his commission and go to war. They stop a moment so Volkheimer can rest, and Werner bends to examine one of the transceivers, draws a little screwdriver from his pocket, and tightens a loose hinge plate. Volkheimer looks down at him with great tenderness.
What you could be, he says.
That night, Werner climbs into bed and stares up at the underside of Friedrich's mattress. A warm wind blows against the castle, and somewhere a shutter bangs and snowmelt trickles down the long downspouts. As quietly as he can manage, he whispers,
Are you awake?
Friedrich leans over the side of his bunk, and for a moment in the nearly complete darkness, Werner believes they will finally say to each other what they have not been able to say.
You could go home, you know, to Berlin, leave this place.
Friedrich only blinks.
Your mother wouldn't mind. She'd probably like to have you around, Franny too, just for a month, even a week. As soon as you leave, the cadets will let up, and by the time you return, they'll have moved on to someone else. Your father wouldn't even have to know.
But Friedrich tips back into his bed, and Werner can no longer see him. His voice comes reflecting down from the ceiling.
Maybe it'd be better if we aren't friends anymore, Werner.
Too loud, dangerously loud.
I know it's a liability, walking with me, eating with me, always folding my clothes and shining my boots and tutoring me. You have your studies to think of.
Werner clenched his eyes. A memory of his attic bedroom swamps him. Clicking of mouse feet in the walls, sleet tapping the window, the ceiling so sloped he could stand only in the spot closest to the door, and the feeling that somewhere just behind his vision, ranged like specters in a gallery, his mother and father and the Frenchman from the radio were all watching him through the rattling window to see what he would do. He sees Jutta's crestfallen face bent over the pieces of their broken radio. He has the sensation that something huge and empty is about to devour them all.
"That's not what I meant," Werner says into his blanket.
But Friedrich says nothing more, and both boys lie motionless a long time, watching the blue spokes of moonlight rotate through the room. Old Ladies' Resistance Club. Madame Ruel, the baker's wife, a pretty-voiced woman who smells mostly of yeast, but also sometimes of face powder or the sweet perfume of sliced apples, straps a stepladder to the roof of her husband's car and drives the Route de Carentan at dusk with Madame Guibault and rearranges road signs with a ratchet set. They return drunk and laughing to the kitchen of No. 4 Rue Vaubray.
"Dinan is now 20 kilometers to the north," says Madame Rouet. "Right in the middle of the sea."
3 days later, Madame Fontenot overhears that the German garrison commander is allergic to goldenrod. Madame Carré, the florist, tucks great fistfuls of it into an arrangement headed for the chateau. The women funnel a shipment of rayon to the wrong destination. They intentionally misprint the train timetable. Madame Ebard, the postmistress, slides an important-looking letter from Berlin into her underpants, takes it home, and starts her evening fire with it. They come spilling into Etienne's kitchen with gleeful reports that someone has heard the garrison commander sneezing, or that the dog shit placed on a brothel doorstep reached the target of a German shoe bottom perfectly. Madame Manek pours sherry, or cider, or muscadet. Someone sits stationed by the door to serve as sentry. Small and stooped, Madame Fontenot boasts that she tied up the switchboard at the chateau for an hour. Dowdy and strapping Madame Gibault says she helped her grandsons paint a stray dog the colors of the French flag and sent it running through the Place Chateaubriand. The women cackle, thrilled.
"What can I do?"
asks the ancient widow, Madame Blanchard.
"I want to do something."
Madame Manek asks everyone to give Madame Blanchard their money.
"You get it back," she says. "Don't worry. Now, Madame Blanchard, you've had beautiful handwriting all your life. Take this fountain pen of Master Etienne's. On every 5-franc note, I want you to write, 'Free France now.' No one can afford to destroy money, right? Once everyone has spent their bills, our little message will go out all over Brittany."
The women clap. Madame Blanchard squeezes Madame Manek's hand and wheezes and blinks her glossy eyes in pleasure. Sometimes Etienne comes down grumbling, one shoe on, and the whole kitchen goes quiet while Madame Manek fixes his tea and sets it on a tray and Etienne carries it back upstairs. Then the women start up again, scheming, gabbling. Madame Manek brushes Marie-Laure's hair in long, absent-minded strokes.
76 years old, she whispers, "and I can still feel like this, like a little girl with stars in my eyes."
Diagnosis. The military doctor takes Sergeant Major von Rumpel's temperature, inflates the blood pressure cuff, examines his throat with a penlight. This very morning, von Rumpel inspected a 15th-century Davenport and supervised its installment into a rail car meant for Marshal Goring's hunting lodge. The private who brought it to him described plundering the villa they took it from. He called it shopping. The Davenport makes von Rumpel think of an 18th-century Dutch tobacco box made out of brass and copper and encrusted with tiny diamonds that he examined earlier this week. And the tobacco box sends his thoughts, as inexorably as gravity, back to the Sea of Flames. In his weaker moments, he imagines walking in some future hour between arcades of pillars in the great Führer Museum at Linz, his heels clacking smartly on the marble, twilight cascading through high windows. He sees 1,000 crystalline display cases, so clear they seem to float above the floor. Inside them wait the world's mineral treasures, harvested from every hole on the globe. Dioptase and topaz and amethyst and California rubellite. What was the phrase? Like stars flung off the brows of archangels. And in the very center of the gallery, a spotlight falls through the ceiling onto a pedestal. There, inside a glass cube, glows a small blue stone. The doctor asked Von Rumpel to lower his trousers. Though the business of war has not let up for even a day, Von Rumpel has been happy for months. His responsibilities are doubling. There are not, it turns out, a lot of Aryan diamond experts in the Reich. Just 3 weeks ago, outside a tiny Sun Street station west of Bratislava, he examined an envelope full of perfectly clear, well-faceted stones. Behind him rumpled a truck full of paintings wrapped in paper and packed in straw. The guards whispered that a Rembrandt was in there and pieces of a famous altarpiece from Krakow, all being sent to a salt mine somewhere deep beneath the Austrian village of Altos, where a mile-long tunnel drops into a glittering arcade filled with shelving 3 stories high, upon which the High Command is stacking Europe's finest art. They will assemble everything under one unassailable roof, a temple to the human endeavor. Visitors will marvel at it for 1,000 years. The doctor probes his groin. No pain? None? Nor here? None? It would have been too much to hope for names from the lapidary in Paris. DuPont, after all, would not have known who had been given the replicas of the diamond. He had no insight into the last-second safeguards of the museum. But DuPont was of service nonetheless. Von Rumpel needed a number, and he got it. 3. The doctor says, "You may dress," and washes his hands at a sink. In the 2 months leading up to the invasion of France, DuPont fashioned 3 replicas for the museum. Did he use the real diamond to make them? He used a casting. He never saw the real diamond. Von Rumpel believed him. 3 replicas, plus the real stone, somewhere on this planet among its sextillion grains of sand. 4 stones, one of them in the basement of the museum, locked in a safe. 3 more to find. There are moments when Von Rumpel feels impatience rising in him like bile, but he forces himself to swallow it back. It will come. He buckles his belt. The doctor says, "We need to take a biopsy. You will want to telephone your wife." Weakest, number 3. The scales of cruelty tip. Maybe Bastien exacts some final vendetta. Maybe Friedrich goes looking for his only way out. All Werner knows for certain is that one April morning he wakes to find 3 inches of slush on the ground and Friedrich not in his bunk. He does not show at breakfast or poetics or morning field exercises. Each story Werner hears contains its own flaws and contradictions, as though the truth is a machine whose gears are not meshing. First he hears that a group of boys took Friedrich out and set up torches in the snow and told him to shoot the torches with his rifle to prove he had adequate eyesight. Then Werner hears that they brought him charts for eye exams, and when he could not read them, they force-fed the charts to him. But what does the truth matter in this place? Werner imagines 20 boys closing over Friedrich's body like rats. He sees the fat, gleaming face of the commandant, throat spilling out of his collar, reclined like a king on some high-backed oak throne, while blood slowly fills the floor, rises past his ankles, past his knees. Werner skips lunch and walks in a daze to the school's infirmary. He's risking detention, or worse. It's a sunny, bright noon, but his heart is being crushed slowly in a vice. Everything is slow and hypnotic, and he watches his arm work as it pulls open the door, as if he's peering through several feet of blue water. A single bed with blood in it, blood on the pillow and on the sheets,
and even on the enameled metal of the bed frame. Pink rags in a basin, half-unrolled bandage on the floor. The nurse bustles over and grimaces at Werner. Outside of the kitchen, she is the only woman at the school. "Why so much blood?" he asks. She sets four fingers across her lips, debating perhaps whether to tell him or pretend she does not know, accusation or resignation or complicity.
"Where is he?"
"Leipzig, for surgery."
She touches a round white button on her uniform with what might be an inconveniently trembling finger. Otherwise, her manner is entirely stern.
"What happened?"
"Shouldn't you be at noontime meal?"
Each time he blinks, he sees the men of his childhood, laid-off miners drifting through back alleys, men with hooks for fingers and vacuums for eyes. He sees Bastien standing over a smoking river, snow falling all around him. "Führer, Volk, Vaterland, steal your body, steal your soul."
"When will he be back?"
"Oh," she says a soft enough word. She shakes her head. A blue soapbox on the table. Above it, a portrait of some foregone officer in a crumbling frame. Some previous boy sent through this place to die.
"Cadet?"
Werner has to sit on the bed. The nurse's face seems to occupy multiple distances. A mask atop a mask atop a mask. What is Jutta doing at this exact moment? Wiping the nose of some wailing newborn, or collecting newspapers, or listening to presentations from army nurses, or darning another sock, praying for him, believing in him. He thinks, "I will never be able to tell her about this." "Dearest Marie-Laure, the others in my cell are mostly kind. Some tell jokes. Here's one. Have you heard about the Wehrmacht exercise program?" "Yes. Each morning, you raise your hands above your head and leave them there." "My angel has promised to deliver this letter for me at great risk. It is very safe and nice to be out of the Gasthaus for a bit. We are building a road now, and the work is good. My body is getting stronger. Today, I saw an oak tree disguised as a chestnut tree. I think it's called a chestnut oak. I would like very much to ask some of the botanists in the gardens about it when we get home. I hope you and Madame and Etienne will keep sending things. They say we will be allowed to receive one parcel each, so something has to get through eventually. I doubt they would let me keep any tools, but it would be wonderful if they would. You absolutely would not believe how pretty it is here, ma chérie, and how far we are from danger. I am incredibly safe as safe can be. Your papa." Grotto. It's summer, and Marie-Laure is sitting in the alcove behind the library with Madame Manek and crazy Arrow Bazin. Through his copper mask, through a mouthful of soup, Harold says, "I want to show you something." He leads Marie-Laure and Madame Manek down what Marie-Laure thinks is the Rue du Boyer, though it could be the Rue Vincent de Gournay or the Rue des Antilles. They reach the base of the ramparts and turn right, following a lane Marie-Laure has not been on before. They descend two steps, pass through a curtain of hanging ivy, and Madame Manek says, "Arrow, please, what is this?" The alley grows narrower and narrower until they must walk single file. The walls close on either side, and then they stop. Marie-Laure can feel stone blocks mounting vertically on both sides to brush their shoulders. They seem to rise forever. If her father has built this alley into his model, her fingers have not discovered it yet. Arrow rummages in his filthy trousers, breathing hard behind his mask. Where the wall of the rampart should be on their left, Marie-Laure hears a lock give way. A gate creaks open. "What's your head?" he says, and helps her through. They clamber down into a cramped, moist space that positively reeks of the sea. We're beneath the wall, 20 meters of granite on top of us.
Madame says,
Really, Harold, it's gloomy as a graveyard in here.
But Marie-Laure ventures a bit further, the soles of her shoes slipping, the floor angling down, and then her shoes touch water.
Feel this,
says Harold Bazin, and crouches and brings her hand to a curved wall which is completely studded with snails. Hundreds of them. Thousands.
So many,
she whispers.
I don't know why. Maybe because they're safe from gulls. Here, feel this. I'll turn it over.
Hundreds of tiny, squirming hydraulic feet beneath a horny, ringed top. A sea star.
Blue mussels here, and there's a dead stone crab. Can you feel his claw? Watch your head now.
The surf breaks nearby. Water pearls past her shoes. Marie-Laure wades forward. The floor of the room is sandy, water barely ankle deep. From what she can tell, it's a low grotto, maybe 4 yards long and half as wide, shaped like a loaf of bread. At the far end is a thick grate through which lustrous, clear sea wind washes. Her fingertips discover barnacles, weeds, 1,000 more snails.
What is this place? Remember I told you about the dogs of the watch? A long time ago, city kennel keepers would keep the mastiffs in here, dogs as big as horses. At night, a curfew bell would ring, and the dogs would be let loose into the beaches to eat any sailor who dared come ashore. Somewhere beneath those mussels is a stone with the date 1165 scratched into it.
But the water?
Even at the highest tides, it doesn't get more than waist deep. Back then, the tides might have been lower. We used to play in here as boys, me and your grandfather. Sometimes your great-uncle, too.
The tide flows past their feet. Everywhere mussels click and sigh. She thinks of the wild old seamen who lived in this town, smugglers and pirates sailing over the dark seas, winding their ships between 10,000 reefs.
Harold, we should go now,
calls Madame Manek, her voice echoing.
This is no place for a young girl.
Marie-Laure calls,
It's fine, madame.
Hermit crabs, anemones, sending out a tiny jet of seawater when she pokes them. Galaxies of snails, a story of life imminent in each. Finally, Madame Manek coaxes them out of the kennel, and crazy Harold leads Marie-Laure back through the gate and locks it behind them. Before they reach the Place Broussais, Madame Manek walking out front, he taps Marie-Laure's shoulder. His whisper comes in her left ear. His breath smells like crushed insects.
Could you find that place again, do you think?
I think so.
He puts something iron in her hand.
Do you know what it is?
Marie-Laure closes her fist.
It's a key.
Intoxicated. Every day there is word of another victory, another advance. Russia collapses like an accordion. In October, the student body gathers around a big wireless to listen to the Fuhrer declare Operation Typhoon. German companies plant flags miles from Moscow. Russia will be theirs. Werner is 15. A new boy sleeps in Friedrich's bed. Sometimes at night, Werner sees Friedrich when he is not there. His face appears over the edge of the upper bunk, or his silhouette presses binoculars to the window pane. Friedrich, who did not die but did not recover. Broken jaw, cracked skull, brain trauma. No one was punished, no one questioned. A blue automobile came to the school, and Friedrich's mother got out and walked into the commandant's residence and emerged soon afterward, tilted against the weight of Friedrich's duffel bag, looking very small. She climbed back into the car and drove it away. Volkheimer is gone. There are stories that he has become a fearsome sergeant in the Wehrmacht, that he led a platoon into the last town on the road to Moscow, hacked off the fingers of dead Russians and smoked them in a pipe. The newest crop of cadets grow wild in their urgency to prove themselves. They sprint, shout, hurl themselves over the obstacles. In field exercises, they play a game where 10 boys get red armbands and 10 get black. The game ends when one team has all 20. Seems to Werner as if all the boys around him are intoxicated, as if at every meal the cadets fill their tin cups not with the cold mineralized water of Schopforta, but with a spirit that leaves them glazed and dazzled, as if they ward off a vast and inevitable tidal wave of anguish only by staying forever drunk on rigor and exercise and gleaming boot leather. The eyes of the most bullheaded boys radiate a shining determination. Every ounce of their attention has been trained to ferret out weakness. They study Werner with suspicion when he returns from Hauptmann's lab. They do not trust that he is an orphan, that he's often alone, that his accent carries a whisper of the French he learned as a child. "We are a volley of bullets," sing the newest cadets. "We are cannonballs. We are the tip of the sword." Werner thinks of home all the time. He misses the sound of rain on the zinc roof above his dormer, the feral energy of the orphans, the scratchy singing of Frau Elena as she rocks a baby in the parlor, the smell of the coking plant coming in under the dawn, the first reliable smell of every day. Mostly he misses Jutta, her loyalty, her obstinacy, the way she always seems to recognize what is right. Though in Werner's weaker moments, he resents those same qualities in his sister. Perhaps she's the impurity in him, the static in his signal that the bullies can sense. Perhaps she's the only thing keeping him from surrendering totally. If you have a sister back home, you're supposed to think of her as a pretty girl in a propaganda poster, rosy-cheeked, brave, steadfast. She's whom you fight for, whom you die for. But Jutta? Jutta sends letters that the school censor blacks out almost completely. She asks questions that should not be asked. Only Werner's affiliation with Dr. Hauptmann, his privileged status as the favorite of the technical sciences professor, keeps him safe. A company in Berlin is producing their transceiver, and already some of their units are coming back from what Hauptmann calls the field, blown apart or burned or drowned in mud or defective, and Werner's job is to rebuild them while Hauptmann talks into his telephone or writes requisitions for replacement parts or spends whole fortnights away from the school. Weeks pass without a letter to Jutta. Werner writes four lines, a smattering of platitudes, "I am fine, I am so busy," and hands it to the bunkmaster. Dread swamps him. "You have minds," Bastian murmurs one evening in the refectory, each boy hunching almost imperceptibly further over his food as the commandant's finger grazes the back of his uniform. "But minds are not to be trusted. Minds are always drifting toward ambiguity, towards questions. Then what you really need is certainty, purpose, clarity. Do not trust your minds." Werner sits in the lab late at night, alone again, and trolls the frequencies on the Grundig tube radio that Volkheimer used to borrow from Hauptmann's office, searching for music, for echoes, for what, he is not sure. He sees circuits break apart and reform. He sees Friedrich staring into his book of birds. He sees the furor of the mines at Zollverein, the shunting cars, the banging locks, the trundling conveyors, smokestacks silting the sky day and night, and he sees Jutta slashing back and forth with a lit torch as darkness encroaches from all sides. Wind presses against the walls of the lab. Wind, the commandant loves to remind them, that comes all the way from Russia, a Cossack wind, the wind of candle-eating barbarians with hogs' heads who will stop at nothing to drink the blood of German girls, guerrillas who must be wiped off the earth. Static, static, are you there? Finally, he shuts off the radio. Into the stillness come the voices of his masters, echoing from one side of his head while memory speaks from the other. Open your eyes and see what you can with them before they close forever. The Blade and the Whelk. The Hotel Dieu dining room is big and somber and full of people talking about U-boats off Gibraltar and the inequities of currency exchange and four-stroke marine diesel engines. Madame Manek orders two bowls of chowder that she and Marie-Laure promptly finish. She says she does not know what to do next. Should they keep waiting? So she orders two more. At last, a man in rustling clothing sits down with them. "You are sure your name is Madame Walker?" Madame Manek says. "You are sure your name is Renee?" A pause. "And her?" "My accomplice. She can tell if someone is lying just by hearing him speak." He laughs. They talk about the weather. Sea air exudes from the man's clothes as if he has been blown here by a gale. While he talks, he makes ungainly movements and bumps the table so that the spoons clatter in their bowls. Finally, he says, "We admire your efforts, madame." The man, who calls himself René, starts talking extremely softly. Marie-Laure catches only phrases. "Look for special insignia on the license plates. WH for Army, WL for Air Force, WM for Navy. And you could note, or find someone who could, every vessel that comes in and out of the harbor. This information is very much in demand." Madame Manek is quiet. If more is said that Marie-Laure cannot overhear, if there is a pantomime going on between them, notes passed, stratagems agreed upon, she cannot say. Some level of accord is reached, and soon enough she and Madame Manek are back in the kitchen at number 4, Rue Vaubarais. Madame Manek clatters around the cellar and hauls up canning supplies. "This very morning," she announces, "she has managed to procure what might be the last 2 crates of peaches in France." She hums as she helps Marie-Laure with the peeler. "Madame?"
"Yes, Marie."
"What is a pseudonym?"
"It's a fake name, an alternate name."
"If I were to have one, what sort of name could I choose?"
"Well," says Madame Manek, she pits and quarters another peach, "you can be anything. You can be the mermaid, if you like, or Daisy, Violet."
"How about the Whelk? I think I would like to be the Whelk."
"The Whelk? That's an excellent pseudonym."
"And you, madame, what would you like to be?"
"Me?"
Madame Manek's knife pauses. Crickets sing in the cellar.
"I think I would like to be the Blade."
"The Blade?"
"Yes."
The perfume of the peaches makes a bright ruddy cloud.
"The Blade," repeats Marie-Laure.
Then they both start laughing. Dear Werner, why don't you write? XXX censor marks here, XXXX censor marks here, XXX. The foundries run day and night, and the stacks never stop smoking, and it's been cold here, so everyone burns everything to stay warm. Sawdust, hard coal, soft coal, lime, garbage, war widows, XXXX censor marks here, XXXX censor marks here, XXX. And every day there are more. I'm working at the laundry with the twins, Hannah and Suzanne, and Claudia Forster, you remember her. We're mending tunics and trousers mostly. I'm getting better with the needle, so at least I'm not pricking myself all the time. Right now, I just finished my homework. Do you have homework? There are fabric shortages, and people bring in slipcovers, curtains, old coats. Anything that can be used, they say must be used. Just like all of us here. I found this under your old cot. Seems like you could use it. Love, Jutta. Inside the homemade envelope waits Werner's childhood notebook, his handwriting across the cover. Questions. Across its pages swarm boyhood drawings, inventions, an electric bed heater he wanted to build for Frau Elena, a bicycle with chains to drive both wheels. Can magnets affect liquids? Why do boats float? Why do we feel dizzy when we spin? A dozen empty pages at the back, juvenile enough, presumably, to make it past the censor. Around him sounds the din of boots, clatter of rifles, stocks on the ground, barrels against the wall. Grab cups off hooks, plates off racks, queue up for boiled beef. Over him breaks a wave of homesickness so acute that he has to clamp his eyes. Alive before you die. Madame Manette goes into Etienne's study on the fifth floor. Marie-Laure listens on the stairs.
You could help, Madame says.
Someone like Madame opens a window, and the bright air of the sea washes into the landing, stirring everything. Etienne's curtains, his papers, his dust, Marie-Laure's longing for her father. Etienne says,
Please, Madame, close the window. They are rounding up blackout offenders.
The window stays open. Marie-Laure creeps down another stair.
How do you know whom they round up, Etienne? A woman in René was given 9 months in prison for naming one of her hogs Goebbels. Did you know that? A palm reader in Cancale was shot for predicting De Gaulle would return in the spring. Shot?
Those are only rumors, madame.
Madame Ebrard says a Denard man, a grandfather Etienne, was given 2 years in prison for wearing the cross of Lorraine under his collar. I heard they're going to turn the whole city into a big ammunition dump.
Her great-uncle laughs softly.
It all sounds like something a sixth former would make up.
Every rumor carries a seed of truth, Etienne.
All of Etienne's adult life, Marie-Laure realizes, Madame Manette has tended his fears, skirted them, mitigated them. She creeps down one more stair. Madame Manette is saying,
You know things, Etienne, about maps, tides, radios.
It's already too dangerous, all those women in my house. People have eyes, madame.
Ooh, the perfumer for one.
Claude? She snorts. Little Claude is too busy smelling himself.
Claude is not so little anymore. Even I can see his family gets more than the others. More meat, more electricity, more butter. I know how such prices are won.
Then help us.
I don't want to make trouble, madame.
Isn't doing nothing a kind of troublemaking?
Doing nothing is doing nothing.
Doing nothing is as good as collaborating.
The wind gusts. In Marie-Laure's mind, it shifts and gleams, draws needles and thorns in the air. Silver, then green, then silver again.
I know ways, says Madame Manette.
What ways? Whom have you put your trust in?
You have to trust someone sometime.
If your same blood doesn't run in the arms and legs of the person you're next to, you can't trust anything. And even then, it's not a person you wish to fight, madame. It's a system. How do you fight a system?
You try.
What would you have me do?
Dig out that old thing in the attic. You used to know more about radios than anyone in town. Anyone in Brittany, perhaps.
They've taken all the receivers.
Not all. People have hidden things everywhere. You'd only have to read numbers, is how I understand it. Numbers on strips of paper. Someone, I don't know who, maybe Arobazine, will bring them to Madame Rouet, and she'll collect them and bake the messages right into the bread. Right into it!
She laughs to Marie-Laure. Her voice sounds 20 years younger.
Harold Bazin? You are trusting Harold Bazin? You are cooking secret codes into bread? What fat kraut is going to eat those awful loaves? They take all the good flour for themselves. We bring home the bread. You transmit the numbers. Then we burn the piece of paper. This is ridiculous. You act like children. It's better than not acting at all. Think of your nephew. Think of Marie-Laure.
Curtains flap and papers rustle, and the two adults have a standoff in the study. Marie-Laure has crept so close to her great-uncle's doorway that she can touch the doorframe. Madame Monek says,
"Don't you want to be alive before you die?"
"Marie is almost 14 years old, madame. Not so young, not so during the war. 14-year-olds die the same as everybody else. But I want 14 to be young. I want..."
Marie-Laure scoots back up a step. Had they seen her? She thinks of the stone kennel Crazy Arrow Bazin led her to, the snails gathered in their multitudes. She thinks of the many times her father put her on his bicycle. She'd balance on the seat, and he would stand on the pedals, and they'd glide out into the roar of some Parisian boulevard. She'd hold his hips and bend her knees, and they'd fly between cars, down hills, through gauntlets of odor and noise and color. Etienne says, "I'm going back to my book, madame. Shouldn't you be preparing dinner?"
No out. In January 1942, Werner goes to Dr. Hauptmann in his glowing firelit office, twice as warm as the rest of the castle, and asks to be sent home. The little doctor is sitting behind his big desk with an anemic-looking roasted bird on a dish in front of him, quail or dove or grouse, rolls of schematics on his right, his hounds splay on the rug before the fire. Werner stands with his cap in hands. Hauptmann shuts his eyes and runs a fingertip across one eyebrow. Werner says,
"I will work to pay the train fare, sir."
The blue fretwork of veins in Hauptmann's forehead pulsates. He opens his eyes. "You?" The dogs look up as one, the three-headed hydra. "You, who gets everything, who comes here and listens to concerts and nibbles chocolates and warms yourself by the fire?"
A shred of roasted bird dances on Hauptmann's cheek. Perhaps for the first time, Werner sees in his teacher's thinning blonde hair, in his black nostrils, in his small, almost elfin ears, something pitiless and inhuman, something determined only to survive.
"Perhaps you believe you are somebody now, somebody of importance?"
Werner clenches his cap behind his back to keep his shoulders from quaking.
"No, sir."
Hauptmann folds his napkin.
"You are an orphan, Fenning, with no allies. I can make you whatever I want to make you, a troublemaker, a criminal, an adult. I can send you to the front and make sure you are crouched in a trench in the ice until the Russians cut off your hands and feed them to you."
"Yes, sir."
"You will be given your orders when the school is ready to give you your orders, no sooner. We serve the Reich, Fenning. It does not serve us."
"Yes, sir."
"You will come to the lab tonight, as usual."
"Yes, sir."
"No more chocolates. No more special treatment."
In the hall, with the door shut behind him, Werner presses his forehead against the wall, and a vision of his father's last moments come to him. The crushing press of the tunnels, the ceiling lowering, jaw pinned against the floor, skull splintering. "I cannot go home," he thinks, "and I cannot stay." The disappearance of Harold Bazin. Marie-Laure follows the odor of Madame Monek's soup through the Place d'Herbes and holds the warm pot outside the alcove behind the library while Madame raps on the door. Madame says,
"Where is Monsieur Bazin?"
"Must have moved on," says the librarian, through the doubt in his voice is only partially disguised.
Where could Arobazin move to? I'm not sure, Madame Manek. Please, it's cold.
The door closes. Madame Manek swears. Marie-Laure thinks of Harold Bazin's stories. Lugubrious monsters made of seafoam, mermaids with fishy private parts. The romance of English seizes.
He'll be back, says Madame Manek, as much to herself as to Marie-Laure.
But the next morning, Harold Bazin is not back, or the next. Only half the group attends the following meeting.
Do they think he was helping us?
Whispers Madame Ebard.
Was he helping us? I thought he was carrying messages. What sort of messages? It's getting too dangerous.
Madame Manek paces. Marie-Laure can almost feel the heat of her frustration from across the room.
Leave then, her voice smolders.
All of you!
Don't be rash, says Madame Rouet. We'll take a break, a week or two. Wait for things to settle.
Harold Bazin, with his copper mask and boyish avidity and his breath like crushed insects. Where, Marie-Laure wonders, do they take people? The Gasthaus her father has taken to, where they write letters home about wonderful food and mythical trees. The baker's wife claims they're sent to camps in mountains. The grocer's wife says they're sent to nylon factories in Russia. It seems as likely to Marie-Laure that the people just disappear. The soldiers throw a bag over whoever they want to remove, run electricity through them, and then that person is gone, vanished, expelled to some other world. The city, thinks Marie-Laure, is slowly being remade into the model upstairs, streets sucked empty one by one. Each time she steps outside, she becomes aware of all the windows above her. The quiet is fretful, unnatural. It's what a mouse must feel, she thinks, as it steps from its hole into the open blades of a meadow, never knowing what shadow might come cruising above.
Well, I'm sorry, but that's all the time we have, as we've come to the end of the book hour in today's reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Dewar. Preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.